Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Welcome to the Ethics Experts. I'm here with Charlie Maloof. How are you doing, Charlie?
I'm doing great, Nick. How are you?
Good, man. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm excited to be here.
Good. Yeah. So I met you at a local event for business leaders. You're a well-known, well-respected CEO in the Charlotte area where we're based. And really, you know, like I was saying before we started recording, within, you know, 5 minutes or a couple minutes of hearing you talk, I was like, oh man, this guy gets it. Like you have an ethos that really resonated with me. I could tell you had a heart for your people and so forth. And as I've kind of gotten to know you over the last, I don't know, maybe it's been a year or something, just following you on LinkedIn and following your company and seeing what you've been doing, I've seen that, you know, what I saw in you that first day was really kind of the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, I really was excited to get you on the Ethics Experts today to really kind of talk about culture, because what you've built in your business is one that I think all of our listeners would be very impressed with if they saw it and felt it. So maybe we can just kind of get started by jumping in and you kind of tell us a little bit about your story, about your business, and then we can start talking about some tactics and stuff like that.
Sure. And let me just say that this is only my second ever podcast to record. And I've been super impressed following you and your story and your brother's story with the Compliance Line, and just learning a little bit about you on you know, meeting at different events or and on LinkedIn. And so it's really cool to kind of understand your story. I'm really excited to speak with you, and we'll have to give it to Gary for being the big connector here.
Yeah, he is. He's like the glue in our community here. This guy, he knows everybody, and we'll definitely give it up to him. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your business, Charlie? Tell us about, you know, what you guys do, and then I'd love to hear kind of how you got into this game.
Yeah, sure. So I'm the president and CEO of Broad River Retail, and Broad River Retail is a licensee of Ashley Home Stores throughout the Carolinas and Georgia. We're actually the largest independently owned and operated licensee of Ashley Home Stores. Ashley Home Stores is the retail arm, if you will, of Ashley Furniture Industries. Why is that important? Ashley Furniture is the largest furniture manufacturer in the world that's ever existed in the world, and they're privately held, and so they're a great company, and we're proud and privileged and honored to be partnered with them. We're a licensee, not a franchisee, so we manage our own culture, run our own business, make our own decisions, and grow and open stores. And so we're headquartered in Fort Mill, South Carolina, effectively Charlotte, the Charlotte area. And our 22 stores are in the Raleigh, Durham, Fayetteville market, the Charlotte, Greater Charlotte, Gastonia, Hickory market, the upstate of South Carolina and Western North Carolina, then Columbia, South Carolina, and Augusta, Georgia. So we're kind of spread out, and you know, we're kind of a little bit different than other maybe retail story that you've read in the news. We've read about the retail apocalypse. We decided we did not want to participate. So
good for you.
So we are still, yeah. So we opened 3 new stores last year. We're opening, we've already opened 1 this year. We've got 2 more, and we're really just we're purpose powered and people powered and fueled by purpose, and just a group of people who have come together and trying to do things a little bit differently with retail. And so we're opening stores and we're trying to grow responsibly. And so that's a little bit about us. I can keep going or I can pause.
Yeah, I have a quick question. So I don't, you know, in case any of our, you know, listeners aren't familiar with your business or your industry, I think it may be lost on some how this sort of sidestep of the retail apocalypse. I mean, who knew you just could just decide, I don't want to be fall victim to that. But I mean, you see a lot of furniture stores closing. You see a lot of these guys moving straight online. You see Wayfairs and stuff like this kind of coming on and soaking up at least a portion of the market. What has kind of driven your strategy, or what has, you know, what has allowed you guys to sidestep this thing and be even opening stores in the face of this apocalypse?
Yeah, so, you know, like anything, Nick, it's not a single one decision. And so there's a lot of things, right? Knowing your numbers and knowing what you've got to do to grow your business. But I will tell you one thing that might be really important. One of the many things that we've done that might be important to the topic that we're talking about today, which is culture and people, is really in 2015, we shifted our whole mindset around people from human resources to human capital.
Yeah.
And it's not to think of people as money. It's really if you've all heard the phrase, people are our greatest asset, right? And many companies say it. But if we're going to like hold ourselves to account on that, then human resources we just saw was an outdated mindset. And so we changed a whole lot, starting with our mindset, with our view of our people in terms of not seeing them as liabilities, not trying to minimize them on the balance sheet, but how do we optimize, grow them, and take a growth-oriented mindset approach to that. And so that whole lens has really kind of taken our growth to a whole other level, I would say.
So, I mean, a lot of that is sort of that counterintuitive thinking. Well, I mean, on the one hand, it's counterintuitive because a lot of people don't actually do it, but it's also kind of interesting because I don't think anybody would sort of on the surface, any leader of any organization would disagree with the saying that, you know, like you said, our people are our greatest asset. But there seems to be this disconnect between that, you know, that headline, which sounds really nice, and the actions, which I think are sort of some kind of are rooted in the heart at some level. So kind of talk to me a little bit about that. What drove that shift? That mentality shift at your organization?
Well, it's a great question. At some level, it may have already always been there, underlining kind of some of our thoughts and actions and beliefs. And so it could have been a bolder, crisper articulation of what we had always believed. But to put it really succinctly, in mid-2015, we had a bit of an upheaval as a company. We had done an ERP transition, and
nightmare. Yeah.
We thought so, and we probably could write the Harvard Business Review for how not to do one, and so we had fumbled and stumbled our way through that. And so anyway, the way I like to think about it is we broke all our bones. And so we're trying to put all the bones back together. And sometimes what holds some folks back are we've always done it this way and it's always been pretty successful and chugged along. And so why change it if it's always worked? Well, we were in a state of a whole lot of creativity because at that time, in that brief moment of time, nothing was working. Everything was failing. So we had the creative freedom to kind of reset and reimagine and not be, you know, kind of held captive to previous successes. We said, you know what? Nothing's working. And I had just taken on the president and CEO role. And so we just kind of had this creative freedom to reset a whole lot of things. We actually had a 100-day challenge and we called it our bold reset. And so that would have just been one of those elements that we reset was our lens of how we thought about our people. And so then there would have been some policies that we changed with regards to that. And so I can speak to a couple of those as an example, if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about those policies in a second. But, you know, that saying that says never let a good crisis go to waste. I mean, the timing of this ERP thing, you know, kind of the ability to kind of wipe that slate clean, coupled with you stepping into this president CEO role, it was kind of, I'm sure at the time it seemed like bedlam and craziness, but in retrospect, it served to probably be like a great kind of restart for the whole organization from a culture standpoint.
Yeah, well, it was either going to work or we were going to fail and go away. So we were fortunate that some of those things kind of worked in our favor.
But did you feel like the organization was kind of thirsty for some kind of a change? Because was everybody there, or did you feel like at some times you were kind of pushing a string up a hill, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there was a core group of people who, let's go back to where we were. We were at the time a very proud company. I'd been with the company for several years, and we were, as one of the owners and the managing partner and the COO, and we were a very proud company and had grown and had a nice heritage and legacy that we had established. And so this was just a troubling season, you know, a 6 month, 7 month season that we had kind of been enduring through this ERP transition. So there was definitely a core group of people who wanted to kind of, who needed to see greener pastures and wanted to kind of see this thing turned around. There were also some other people who, quite frankly, we had to be real frank and say, you know, we had to get some of those folks off the bus because they were believing the negativity and weren't really contributing to where we wanted to go. So it was a chance to figure out a big reset to say, we're going to change this. We're all getting on the bus together to go in this direction. And if you don't want to go with us, that's fine, but get out of our way. I don't mean to be mean, but, but we're going here. And so that, and so that's, so, I mean, you know, some of the folks we had to part with.
Yeah. And so let's just stop on that for a sec, because that's always a hard thing, right? Like, at what point do you sort of hit that tipping point of certainty where you say, you know what, this is not sort of a mindset issue. This is not a brain issue. This is not sort of a decision that this person needs in their, needs to make in their head, but this is a heart issue, or this is a way that, that they look at the world, you know, that's so contrary to like this new direction. How do you get that certainty? And maybe it's different for every single person, but I mean, can you speak into that a little bit?
Yeah, and I'm sure that it's somewhat different. I think that if you protect, if as a leader, if you empower others to make confident, bold decisions and people decisions, and you repair the broken windows, and you don't accept those certain beliefs or negativity into the room, and you just declare it's not going to be that way, I think that you know, some things will happen, right? Certain people will eventually opt out themselves, mm-hmm. and they'll make your job easy. And then you have to be willing. One of the things we said during that time is we're going to embrace tough conversations, not out of like we're trying to be mean. We're just going to be real frank and real with each other. And once you do that consistently over time, then others feel empowered to do the same. And so, and then others who that's not for them, it becomes really easy. They're going to eject themselves out. And you start to get, you know, people who are additive to the culture to become sticky and to recruit others into that culture. And they want the bad seeds out, so to speak, or those who aren't part of where we're going. So, you know, it's just, I don't know if that kind of helps, but
yeah,
I think you've got to just,
does.
Yeah.
So like those tough conversations or that embracing of those tough conversations, how did you culturally at that time make sure that those were rooted in the positive versus letting those sort of degrade into, you know, as you said it, like being mean or being jerks or something like that? Because I've seen that kind of go both ways.
Yeah. So, you know, one is, you know, communication is leadership. And so not trying to sugarcoat the current state. Talk about the current state, embrace it, and then talk about where we're going to go, and using some visioning and vision casting. And so not shying away, not calling it more or less than it is, but also just saying we are better than this. We have been better than this. We will be better than this. We're going to get better than this. And just being consistent. And then following through, we're going to do the actions, make the decisions, the things that's required to do this. And also we're going to pick up our shovel every day. Like as a leader, you have to be in the fight. If you're in a foxhole, you can't be on the golf course.
You got to be like, out there with the guys.
You can't be on vacation. You can't like, eject yourself from the fight. You gotta be out there and, in the fight with people every day and making those decisions. And so I think once people see that you're in the fight with them and you're not going to, it's not a today decision. And then a tomorrow is going to be a different flavor. However the wind blows, it's going to be water dripping on a stone every single day. Then, and that you're not going away and that you're there, you know, proximity is power and time is love and investing time with people. And then and then you say, look, Rome's not built in a day. We're not getting out of here in a day. It's going to take some time and we're going to play the long game. And so all those are just tactics that you just kind of commit to and believe in, and then just continue to see them through. It's kind of like losing weight, if you will. And I know I can't like lose all this weight all at once, but if I like do so, if I eat a little bit better and I commit to that and I exercise regularly, and I'm going to start to see the results over a long period of time.
Yeah. So I think, you know, maybe it's like, you know, the thing with kids is kind of a great analogy, and I don't think I appreciated it until I had some of my own, but I think like your net happiness with kids is definitely higher, but your day-to-day happiness might have like more standard deviation or more like, you know, ups and downs. Cause like there's freaking frustrating times when it's like, okay, go to bed or whatever, you know, whatever it is. But what you're talking about is a lot of consistency. And I think that consistency allows for folks to say, okay, well, I guess we're going on this journey and this is the way, you know, the wind's at our backs and this is the way we're going. And I think there may be a lot of fear at the onset of that journey, but as you start moving and as they start seeing, you know, you in the foxhole with them and you're not on the golf course, or, you know, you kind of, like you said, leading from the front, so to speak, that trust begins to build and the buy-in starts to come so that folks can start to see like, okay, it doesn't have to be the way it was. And, you know, the journey that we're on and the destination we're walking toward is going to be a greener pasture than that which we're leaving.
That's right. And then, so if you're going to run a marathon, right, you don't just celebrate at the very end once you get there. And what I mean by that is there's science to celebrating the small wins. And so every day or every week, let's celebrate the small wins, and it's not hard to find them, right? And so all that does is that builds momentum, and it builds encouragement, and it builds positivity, and it trains you to look for them. And so sometimes that's what you need. You need to find those small wins to build those victories and build them upon themselves. And then those become habits, and then you can have success that builds upon success. It's the whole flywheel effect, right?
It's
a lot harder to push in the beginning than it is once it starts to get going.
So how did you get into this game? Like, you know, a lot of this leadership stuff you're talking about, it rolls off your tongue, and it rolls off your tongue because you actually live it. But where did you learn all this stuff, and how did you kind of get into this role of being a real leader to this massive organization?
Well, it wasn't a massive organization when I joined it, and I got in the way, my joke is, I got into retail the way that the traditional way, through technology. And so I had a small technology company in Mississippi. Again, that's where all great technology companies are born.
Yeah, it's like the Silicon Valley of the South.
That's right. Thank you so much. It's great. You're like completing my sentences every day. So. So we were a small shop, and we were doing things like web development, search engine marketing, email marketing, software development, e-commerce websites, a lot of database programming and custom development. So I had that company. I was in that industry for a couple of years, and then I fell in love with the internet and when it was, you know, coming of age in the late 90s and what it could do to transform business. And so I then started my own company. I did it for 5 years. And then, quite honestly, I had a former colleague of mine and a friend of mine who had started up this Ashley Home Store licensee in Charlotte, North Carolina. He also was from Mississippi. And he and another guy had co-founded, they got one store, and then they eventually got a second store, and they were about to acquire a third store. And then he started kind of calling me, and I'd been to visit him, you know, once, and he had told me, hey, I think I'm on the ground floor of the next McDonald's. And, you know, he started showing me some of the numbers, and it just sounded really cool and exciting.
Yeah.
And so he started to recruit me to move. And I said, well, you know, Jonathan, I don't know anything about furniture. I don't really even like, you know, shopping. I never liked it growing up. He said, look, it's just widgets. It's business. You know about business. And so anyways, he made me an offer to join them to buy in as a partner. And so I felt a spiritual calling on my life at that time. And so I sold my house. I kind of sold everything I owned, packed the rest up, and moved to Charlotte and never really looked back. And that was May 1st, 2005. And I joined the day we opened store number 3. And so we just kind of, we had our own kind of survival stories. We would open kind of a store a year, so more or less. And then we bought out the original one of the other co-founders, and Jonathan and I kind of ran the business for several years. And, I learned a lot from him. He was a great leader. He was our president and CEO, and we were great friends. And then over time, he decided he wanted to move on. And quite honestly, we had survived some really tough times, like the Great Recession.
Sure. Yeah.
For our industry,
what was that like?
Incredibly tough. Oh my gosh, that was most half the stores in our industry closed, and many of our other companies closed. And basically, take your business, and if your revenues got cut in half overnight, what would that be like? So most of our stores, their revenues got cut in half overnight, and that's because of, you know, people weren't what we had really decided and discovered is that they got cut in half because we were in some artificial bubble for a couple years prior to that. And so then the bubble burst, and then it went way, the pendulum swung way the other way, where we were in what's the opposite of a bubble, because it was certainly not
hole.
Real, but
right.
So we're in the black hole of furniture sales, and you know, when people can't get financing and can't refinance their house or don't move homes and have constricted credit and for whatever reason, and banks are trying to get rid of all their, so it was just tough. So we actually, the crazy thing is, Nick, is we grew through that time. And
so you guys didn't close any stores during that time.
We did not close any stores, and we actually grew. And I'll tell
That's
you,
crazy.
One of our most inflexible costs that we had determined was this concept about occupancy costs that Jonathan, you know, was really keen on and understood really well. And he managed kind of all of our real estate portfolio and our leases. And he said, you know, we looked at it and we said, okay, we've got these leases. We can try to go back to our landlords, but you know, that's just kind of like making a deal with the devil, so to speak, mm-hmm. meaning eventually we're going to have to pay the piper, and we can only kind of get these reduced so much. And our revenue, what can we do to drive revenues? You can only cut so much of expenses. And all we were trying to do is lengthen our runway. That's where it was, just survival mode in 2009, March 2009, right? And so we actually, there were some stores that had gone out of business and closed in the Columbia market and then in the Augusta market. And we could now get new leases for stores that didn't cannibalize our existing core business at a much lower occupancy cost, even though the revenues were lower, and do them through our current infrastructure. And so we saw it as dollar cost averaging down our cost structure.
Your lease cost, your occupancy cost across the system dropped effectively with a lower revenue base. It allowed you to kind of like, I don't know, cross collateralize is the wrong word, but it's that kind of thing on a revenue basis.
That's correct. That's correct. So when you can pick up, when you can pick up new leases at a much lower percentage, it can dollar cost average down the total portfolio. And so when the banks were telling us, no, don't grow, the world's going, in a really dark place. And we said, no, we have to grow to survive, to protect all the jobs and people's livelihoods who we have, who are entrusted with us. That was the mindset that we grew from 2009 through really 2014, and so that's how we grew through that season and survived. And it was just growth that added to the stability, and that worked up until to a point. We've since shifted that mindset, but that I think I'm not even really sure where we were getting.
No, we just got to something like interesting, and something you said, which is like embedded in who you are and how you guys run the company, I think. Is, you know, the bank saying, you guys got to stop, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, whatever. And you say, no, we have to grow to survive because of these people and these lives that have been entrusted to us to steward. So that
Correct.
Is a thing that is a differential that maybe goes back to what we were talking about initially about, you know, some of these threads in the tapestry of people first kind of have always been there. But it seems like, look, at the end of the day, we'd love to say that, hey, you know, we hold all these different things, we hold them at the same level. But when the rubber meets the road, or it's, you know, you're in the foxhole, as you said, or it's the bottom of the ninth, or whatever analogy you want to use, you can really tell what people's true priorities are. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that, because you just kind of said it and passed over it. But to me, that's like the root of the tree, what you just said there.
And just talking about being in the fight with people, is that the thread you want me to pull?
Yeah, that. But I mean, I'm just saying, like all these other stores, they had a bunch of people You know, whoever your competitor is, Acme Furniture,
yeah.
they had a bunch of people. They had the same opportunity to buy a store in Columbus that probably wouldn't cannibalize their thing. They could have looked at it the same sort of dollar cost averaging perspective and done the same play. But there was something in the way that you guys prioritized your list of priorities or whatever, or your opportunity set that allowed you to say, no, we have to grow to survive. And it sounds like that was rooted in your perceived stewardship of the lives that you had been sort of entrusted with to provide opportunities for. And I'm just talking about the people that were part of this equation.
Yeah. And, you know, that's always been part of our equation, Nick. And you know, why didn't other folks move into Columbia? They certainly had the opportunity to, you know, we had done so, but you know, at that time, I don't know, a lot of people didn't think, they thought the world was going to a really dark place. And so it's this contrarian view. A lot of times, you know, there's this thinking that if you can take a contrarian view and be right, it can have really nice rewards. And maybe a contrarian view was growth at that time. Maybe today a contrarian view is that retail can be successful in a world of Amazon, or that people can make a difference when people are talking about artificial intelligence and robots. So so I'm willing to take a contrarian view and bet on myself, but also really to bet on our people. And so when you're in the fight with them, you can look in their faces, you can look in their souls, and you can see what they're willing to put forth into something. And then you just feel a sense of responsibility. Well, if they're willing to give and sacrifice for something that you benefit from as a business owner or just a coworker, then you have to. But you know, it's just yes, you're definitely right that belief on people has always been a thread in our tapestry, if you will, that we've had, and maybe it's not been specific to everyone, but it has been authentic to how we've tried to lead the company. And you know, we're not trying to be greedy, be self-serving through this business, you know, or just to serve the few. We, you know, I know you talk a lot about servant leadership, and you know, that's really how we see it. And you know, it goes to our beliefs of it's the Matthew 25:23 story parable, right? It's like what you've been entrusted with, what can you be a steward of? And so whether it's your potential or whether it's other people's lives and livelihoods, it's just a heavy responsibility of, you know, when you take stock of where you are in your life and how you got there and all the people who invested in you, you know, and made sacrifices to get you to where you are. I mean, those people deserve a positive return on their investment for what they put forth. And oh,
in
by
trust.
The way,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Right. And you know, I love the John Maxwell quote, be a river, not a reservoir. You know, life flows through a river and a reservoir squashes life. And so it's just a pay it forward mindset. And so at this moment in time and where we are in life, we're entrusted with lives and livelihoods and people's jobs and families and who depend on us to make sound financial, fiscal decisions. And that's just a heavy thing that we live with and we take very seriously. And if you're going to be a leader today, you better take it seriously. And that's just our mindset. I can't really, you know, weigh how that compares to someone else's mindset, because I'm sure plenty of people have a similar comparable mindset. But that's just something, that's the way we try to think about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there's definitely a lot of people who have that mindset, but I don't think that it's most people by any means. And I think at some level, what we're talking about is kind of dollars over people. Are you profit first or are you people first? And I find that as I talk to leaders and as I learn and as I, you know, grow and see what's out there and hear stories and stuff, it seems like that dollar myopic view that sort of puts people subservient to profits, and while sort of makes the most sense from a tangible, you know, Excel spreadsheet perspective, it ends up not producing the long run outcomes that people expect. And I think the view that you take and the one that I try to take and my brother tries to take in our business, and the ones that I think are sort of foundational to the most successful businesses over the long term, are those views that put people first and recognize that profits and dollars are a byproduct of building something great and a byproduct of taking care of people and so forth. And I think when people can buy into that and get it, then they can really unleash a lot of the stuff that, you know, the whole purpose of this podcast is really, you know, about trying to unleash and about trying to turn those light bulbs on at the top for these folks who have kind of come up in that 80s style MBA, you know, that Wharton School of Business approach that says, you know, people are labor units. I mean, which is effectively a vestigial sort of carryover from this stuff, you know, from centuries old during the Industrial Revolution. This is something else I was talking to somebody else about. But putting these people first, you know, it ends up kind of creating this self-fulfilling prophecy. And as you were kind of describing, you know, it was kind of an interesting thing as you were just describing this, you know, this kind of picture in the foxhole, and you're looking at into the eyes of these people, and, you know, they've trusted me and it's my duty for them. It's this cool self-fulfilling prophecy, which is sort of the beauty of culture. Well, that trust was built by you or by the leader at some level by saying, hey, we're going to do this. And, you know, I'm going to create this safe space for you. And that trust that is garnered and that trust that's sort of elicited from that individual ends up serving as fuel if the leader lets it, to allow them to continue that thing forward. And it builds more trust and it builds more, you know, energy toward that leader. And it starts to turn into this perpetual motion machine if people can get the money out of the way. And before you know it, to your point, this river can be a raging river of, you know, profitability, quote unquote, both in terms of experiences, in terms of security for individuals, for them to put their God-given gifts to work, for, you know, dollar profit to distribute, you know, both to owners and to other stakeholders and things like that. It's a really cool picture that you painted as you were describing that.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, I think you hit it on the head, because when you were speaking in the first part of it, you led into the long-term view. And I really do think it's the profits over people is short-termism, and the people over over dollar signs is long-termism. And so, and it gets into, if you make a dollar first decision, that you've got a myopic, you got a mindset of scarcity.
Correct. And if you take that's a huge point. Please say that again. That is a really, really big point that you just made.
So if you take a dollar view, you've got a myopic short-term view that's one born out of a mindset of scarcity. If you take a people decision or apply a people decision, you're really taking a long-term decision that comes from a spirit not of scarcity but one of abundance.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just and so we're willing to take a really long-term view to invest in our people, and even if those decisions are going to be negative in the short term, that's okay. We're going to trust and have faith in our people and the power of our people, the potential of our people, and the trust in our people that we're looking out for them in the short term and in the long term. And so, you know, people are always going to look at you and the decisions you make on a daily basis to see if they can trust you, right? And there's so many opportunities in our society to look at things that you shouldn't trust or can't trust or to be skeptical. And so every decision is an opportunity for transparency or for long-termism and for people. And so that's, you know, just a little bit to extend what you were saying there.
Yeah, and why is that so hard for guys? Why is that so hard for people to wrap their head around that sort of abundance scarcity dichotomy, or that long-term short-term view, in your opinion or in your experience?
Well, I mean, there's probably a lot of answers to that. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure on Wall Street today to get instant results, right? Or to just get the results today, or just get the results this quarter. And so maybe some of it comes from that, right? What are you doing for me now versus what are you building for the long term? What's the culture look like for the long term? Or how are you taking care of your people in the long term? In the long term, that mindset will pay off, but it takes longer. And so, does everyone know a patient investor versus you know, a private equity group that's got a 3-year horizon? So they don't really care what the culture is going to be in 30 years. They got a 3-year horizon, and they're going to apply some financial engineering and then flip it and give that bag to somebody else. I see it happen all the time in my industry.
Yep. Same here.
There's a company in our industry that was a powerful regional player, family owned, and they sold out to a private equity group. And I'm not trying to bash private equity. That's not what this comment is about, because it can be good in many cases. But you know, there were some decisions that were made for short-termism maybe and not for long-termism. And that company, that once very proud company that had just filed for bankruptcy or is filing for bankruptcy, and there should have been no reason for that. There should have been no reason for all these people to kind of be concerned for their jobs and their livelihood. But the culture completely corroded, and it was born out of all those decisions that were made from, you know, I won't kind of wax too much on that. But
well, it's a big deal that actually is showing up in every single industry. And our insights team just put something together on this. And it's like the more people I talk to, the more of this thing that you just mentioned I'm seeing everywhere. And it's that short-term thing. And it's, you know, my brother uses the analogy, if you're going to buy a house and you're going to live in that house for 40 years, you're going to do your renovations in a totally different way than if you're just going to buy it and flip it in a year and a half. If you're in the latter, you're going to put some linoleum down, you're going to slap some paint on the walls, you're going to power wash the driveway, and you're going to move on. You may even spray paint the lawn. Okay. But the other way, you're going to maybe change the foundation, and you're going to do those things that over the long term are actually going to work. So you could talk a little bit about, you know, without getting into too many details that, you know, may be confidential or whatever. How do you balance those short-term needs? Because I'm sure you have financing in place. I'm sure it's not all a cash business, especially with all your leases. Your landlords probably don't care about your culture to the extent it sort of jeopardized their rent. So how do you balance that sort of stuff? Or how does your sort of financing or like ownership structure allow for that long-term approach, which again, in my opinion, is like the only way to properly run a business as a going concern, as the going concern being the big thing?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question. And so we went through an ownership change a couple years ago. And I was an owner of the company, and it was just two owners, for several years. And as I shared earlier, you know, my previous business partner had decided he wanted to move on, and I wasn't quite ready. It wasn't what I felt like I was called to do. And so we had brought on two other gentlemen who have been instrumental in our business, and they're my business partners today. And so we negotiated a deal to buy out my other business partner. Now, knowing that he wanted to sell, you know, I could have said, go sell the company, and we've built it up now, and we can get a really nice return, and you know, my family will be set for life. And that wasn't the decision that I went. So in 2018, it wasn't probably super popular to buy a big retail furniture company, but that's what I did. And, you know, myself and my two business partners, we pushed all of our chips in, pushed all my chips in, took on all the risk, don't have an exit strategy. We had a bank that helped to support the acquisition, and I wanted to be a very amicable acquisition with Jonathan, and I think he would tell you that it was. And you know, those deals are tough to do, but we got it done. And so because we wanted to work together, we wanted to continue to build a company for a very long period of time, and that's just what we wanted to do. And so we also could have done it a couple of years earlier, but it would have been maybe excess leverage or excess debt or things of that nature or too much risk. And so we did it in a way, there was only a certain amount of leverage that I wanted to strap on the business. And so it was done with a very acceptable level relative to our revenues and profits. And I knew how we could continue to improve upon that and de-lever and retire our debt aggressively. And so we've been able to do that. But also the other way, Nick, is, you know, to the extent that we can, we're just transparent. So we say one of the things that we say a lot of times is we're not the cable company. We're not the cell phone company. We're not Netflix. We don't have subscribers. So we have to bring in dollars every single day. Now, we also say that's not a game that everyone can play or that everyone wants to participate in, but that's the game that we're in. We think that that we can be successful in this business model. We know that we can be successful in this business model, and just the model itself might have some level of competitive moat around it because it's capital intensive and not everyone wants to be in this type of business. But we're going to be in this type of business, and we're going to love it and embrace it. And so our people at our retail stores, they have a budget every single day. They know what they have to do And then we're going to throw handsome rewards and bonuses, performance bonuses and incentives for hitting the budget. Now we're going to build our financial budget.
Not redline it.
So we're going to make sure that we've got plenty of conservativeness to it. And we're going to understand all the dials that we have to hit. And then we're going to provide all the incentives to go beat those dials. And that comes from that contribution margin that spits off the healthy profit that we need to handsomely reward our people and keep the engine running and keep it growing. So I think, you know, to the extent that I can, that's some level of kind of letting you know, but yeah, I mean, we understand our numbers. We live within really strict, rigid budgets, and then we're transparent with our people. So, and they understand that we're looking out for their best interests, and that we have a heart to grow, and that we're going to take a long-term view, and then we just continue to execute on our plan. We say this is what it means to be successful, to grow, and what that can mean for you, and then we're all in it together, and then we just. Just water dripping on a stone every single day.
Yeah, you know? It's again, it's that long-term view. It's that one foot in front of the other on this journey. Let me ask you this: you've kind of gone all in twice on this deal. Once in I think 2005, and once again in I think you said 2018. Which one was scarier?
That's such a good question. I don't. Really know how to answer that. In 2005, I was single. I was not married, no kids, and so it was just me. So the only risk I had, and I was much younger. So the only risk I had was, the only scary part was moving to a brand new city and only knowing one person there in a brand new industry. But that's got all I left an industry I completely loved and knew and was being successful in. So that had that element of scariness or risk, whatever you want to call it. But that was a decision made on faith. And I said, I'm going to go step to it and step through it and do it. And then the one, a couple of years ago was, I just feel like, the Lord had kind of just readied me over the course of my entire life. To step through that decision and just a lot of things can kind of happen and being paying attention to divine intervention. I mean, now I'm married with two kids and there's a lot more people involved. But it didn't feel scary. I mean, I don't think either of them really felt scary. I guess maybe I was just too naive about it, but I don't know. I don't know that I would pick one. I'll take some cop-out answer on that one.
Good, that's really fine. Good, a cop-out answer is a fine answer in this podcast. Okay.
Okay, great.
Let's talk a little bit about, you have 22 stores. They're across, I don't know, hundreds of miles. How many people are in your system? A few thousand probably, right? At least 2,000?
Not quite. We've got about 600 memory makers. And through our retail stores and our distribution center and call center, contact.
Okay.
Center.
So that's a lot of people. So how do you maintain sort of a consistent ethos, a consistent feel across that broad, diverse group of individuals in different locations and different sort of little subcultures? I mean, since when I moved to the South, I didn't realize how there's all these little pockets of subculture. So maintain that sort of consistency across this broad group of folks and make sure that the feeling somebody gets walking into one of your stores up north is the same as the one walking, down in Atlanta or something?
Yeah. Old school and new school. So let me explain. So new school would be like technology, right? So there's an app called Voxer. So all of our retail stores, we're on a GM Voxer line. I'm on that Voxer line. It's like CB radio for your cell phone. So we chat, we communicate every single day on the Voxer chat line. And we've got from consistency in how we present to the guest, something called the Broad River Way. And it's a system for teaching our leaders and standard operating policies and procedures. We've got SharePoint and weekly newsletters and videos and just lots and lots of communication and annual plans. Old school, we would bring people in. We would bring people in for monthly meetings, and we would, or we'll go on the road for retail roadshows and town hall sessions and visiting people, you know, face to face. I was President's Day. Every major holiday, you know, is a big time for us in stores.
Right.
So I don't have off when traditional people, you know, who might be bankers or lawyers or doctors, they might have off mm-hmm. work. I mean, we're not working the standard Monday through Friday, you know, 8 to 5, 9 to 5, whatever. So, you know, we visited stores all day Monday on President's Day. And so just being with your people and visiting them and spending time with them. So that's what I mean by kind of new school, old school. And so, but a lot of communication, a lot of, teaching, training, and you know, we've had leadership summits, we've had purpose summits. You know, we definitely want to invest in our leaders and grow our leaders, and then kind of building that brand, the Broad River Retail brand, as its own subculture within the Ashley Home Store licensee network. So we're known and what we stand for and who we are. We have a purpose, a unified purpose. We have annual themes. We've got a unified vision, mission, and values. And then you know, but every store is going to have its own unique subculture, and we're okay with that, right? There's got to mm-hmm. be some latitude to let people. So we say purpose begins with identity. And so you might go to some stores and they might say, yeah, we're at store 9234. Okay, what is store 9234? We want every GM in store to tell us what your store's nickname is. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. And then we custom design their own logo. So we've got, every store's got their own logo, their own identity, what they're about. And so they've got their own store culture. And they put those badges put them on their polo shirts or on their hats or on their cowbell. We've got cowbell that we ring when someone gets enrolled in our VIP program, just to kind of keep the energy going. So we do things like that. So a lot of new school, old school type of things that we do to try to keep everyone unified and on the same page. And you know, you got to bring people together often.
Yeah, I love that. I love that room that you carve out for that individuality, but still being able to root it in the same purpose or the same principles that govern really the kind of pillars of your culture. I think it's a mm-hmm. great thing. And to kind of bring this full circle, just to be conscious of time, so this is my bet. We did not rehearse this, and please share whatever you want. But my bet is that you're you know, Broad River Retail is probably a top performer on a per store basis or something across the other sort of Ashley Home Store licensees in the country. That's my bet. Am I wrong?
Well, that's certainly always our goal. But I would tell you that there's 700 plus stores in North America, Ashley Home Stores in North America. There's over 1,000 across the globe. But of the ones in North America, they do this thing called Store of the Year. And in the top 10 for Store of the Year, we had 3 of the top 6.
Wow.
So, yeah, so we
it's huge,
we made
man.
Up something. Yeah, yeah. So we're our teams, they fight hard for it. They're gritty gladiators. But we came up with something called the AFL. It doesn't exist. It's just called the Ashley Furniture League. And so our goal is to try to win the AFL every year.
I love that. Yeah, but you know, what I meant by trying to bring it full circle is that for some of these leaders who may be listening, who are kind of on the fence around this sort of, you know, scarcity versus abundance mentality or the short term mm-hmm. versus the long term thinking, I think what you've proved with your business is that doing those things of putting people first does not mean that, you know, profits don't matter. As a matter of fact, by recognizing that those profits are a byproduct, it really frees your people to generate more of those in an organic, authentic mm-hmm. way that's not cutting corners and that's actually sustainable over the long run, which is a big deal.
Yeah, yeah, we don't think profit's a bad thing, and we know that profit creates opportunities and growth, and so we want to have double digit compounded annual sales, but also double digit compounded annual profits.
Right.
And so that's our goal, because we're going to reinvest it back into our people, into our company, and into opportunities. But you're right, you know, we do want to be highly profitable and successful, but that starts with our people first and furnishing life's best memories. When we say our purpose is furnishing life's best memories, it starts with our own people. And it's really an outward mindset. It's for other people. It's furnishing life's best memories for other people. And when we say be memory makers, I want to be memory makers for our people. And mm-hmm. they'll then go be memory makers for our guests. And then that'll allow the company to be memory makers for our neighbors and our community. And so that's what it's all about for us.
Well, this conversation was just phenomenal. I love what you're doing. I had no doubt it was going to be this good, and it ended up being better than I even thought. So I just appreciate you hopping on. I appreciate your candor and transparency with us. Where can people find you both kind of online if they want to kind of follow you? And, you know, where are some, maybe remind us of like where your stores are at again so that they can come and get some memories for their own home.
Yeah, I love that, Nick. Thank you so much for having me. I love what you and your brother are doing with Compliance Line. I'm a big fan. Anything we can do to help you guys and support you, we're all in, and we're behind you guys. So thank you for having me today, and thank you for the kind words. And we're just blessed with amazing people, and we'd love to take care of anyone who's shopping for furniture and mattresses in any of the Charlotte area Ashley Home stores, Asheville, Raleigh, Durham, Fayetteville, Columbia, South Carolina, Augusta, Georgia, or Greenville, Spartanburg, or Anderson, South Carolina, any Ashley Home stores in any of those markets, we'd love to take care of you guys. And I'm on LinkedIn. I'm sure you'll put the link in the show notes here, but connect with me, and I'd love to connect with you and your people who follow this podcast.
Absolutely. All right, Charlie, thank you so much, my man. Have a great day.